the hope, done sensibly, is that the incentives for investment and economic growth will bring in enough growth and therefore tax revenue.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Welcome to Wednesday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand here on the 720 WG in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's 12:14. We'll jump right into it. Terry Savage is in the studio. You heard her voice. And about, well, it's 12:14, so in 61 minutes.
Well, no.
We will know what...
Not everything.
I read somewhere... Right, because it's not just about the numbers.
Right, it's
about what they say about it. We're talking about the Fed, and they're expected to announce another increase in the interest rate. I read somewhere this morning that they were calling it one of the most important Fed decisions in years.
It is an important and significant decision because it's one of those rare moments where the Fed is damned if they do and damned if they don't. Now, they said last month we're pretty close to where we want to be. And, you know, it was only two months ago that people were thinking, oh, they're going to raise rates all the way into 2019.
Right.
But last month they said, you know, we're pretty close to where we want to be. So everybody said, okay, yeah, they'll raise rates one more time in December. And the market's pretty well got that baked in, but the market and the reaction of the market's going to be, oh, another rate. We didn't really need this. So that's not good for the market. But watch what happens. What if the Fed doesn't raise rates? Now, that won't because President Trump is saying don't raise rates.
It's what people will think.
It's No. Nobody thinks Jerome Powell is going to be pushed around by the president, and that's the real issue. If the Fed doesn't raise rates, all the smart money is going to go, wait a minute, what numbers is the Fed looking at? Because they said they're data dependent. What do they know that we don't know about this economy? Maybe the economy's in worse shape and the Fed's afraid to raise rates because we're really weak in the economy. And then the market will tank because they'll go, oh my gosh, the Fed knows something we don't know. They know the economy's weak. They're afraid to raise rates. Oh, the end is nigh. So they're damned if they do and damned if they don't.
So coming into the start of the show, the Dow was up 300 points. I think it's up a little more than 200 now in anticipation, right? So they're expecting that there will be a 0.25% increase.
Well, no, that's why this is so consequential, because there's a lot of doubt out there now. I would say greater odds that the Fed will proceed with its 0.25% increase, because they're looking down the road thinking we got to get rates back up so we have some ability to cut them if we ever need to in the future. So I assume they're probably going to raise rates. But there are more signs all around that things aren't just all right with this economy.
Tell me
and
about
that's what's shaking the market.
And we were talking off the air about the FedEx numbers. They're down,
yeah, Federal,
I think, 10%. They're just being pummeled this year.
And the chairman of Federal Express, in his conference after his earnings, said, you know, we look at things happening around the world. And between Brexit and Europe, what's going on, and these insane, I think the CEO said,
He blamed the crazy tariffs.
He blamed all the political decisions being made around the world for slowing economies. They're going to cut workers and so forth and service in Europe. And they're even offering buyouts in the U.S., preparing for what he obviously feels could be a weakening U.S. economy. And the reason it matters more about FedEx than any other company, you know, when you're in the hospital and they say, oh, our vital signs are stable or whatever. You know, I think it's your blood pressure.
Well,
your
I watch Chicago Med.
Right. So I think FedEx is one of the vital signs of the global economy, because they feel it first when stuff doesn't get bought, sold, and moved. And I think the FedEx announcement was very significant. I think that impacted the market.
I want to ask you another question that I asked John Najarian yesterday, and I'm interested in...
Oh, I want to hear what he said.
I'm interested in how your answers differ. So critics of the Trump tax cut said that it would give the economy a sugar high that wouldn't last. And, you know, the stock market certainly rose, the productivity was up and all of that. Here we are having the worst December since the Depression in the markets. So given that, is that a sign that those critics were correct, that we're crashing from a sugar high or not?
No, it's a sign that this administration shot itself in the foot or some other more painful region. Because just when they gave the economy some certainty about tax rates and allowed companies to repatriate money, a lot of which now is in a big dispute, even in FedEx's case, about how that will be taxed. They have done some crazy things. They've debated the taxation of the repatriation. That's caused a lot of uncertainty. The tariffs, for sure, have caused all kinds of dislocations in everything from farming to housing. And all this uncertainty is what's destroyed what could have been thank you, Mr. Trump, at that point, for a tax cut that gave Americans a chance to compete globally.
Do you know what Nigerian said?
What?
The same thing.
He did. Great minds, I'm very happy.
He said essentially, you know, that the tariffs are the result of this problem, not so much the coming down from the sugar.
A huge portion is the tariffs.
All right, it's now 12:19. We're going to take a break and talk about credit card debt coming up after a break while you head to the mall or shop online.
Yeah, I want to catch you just in time. But wait, don't shop.
So we've reached what? The levels we had?
Okay, look at this.
Come on.
You know, the markets may change. But the one reason I always have a job talking about this is because human nature never changes.
So we go through the Great Recession, and people learn their lesson.
Oh, they learned their lesson about debt. They lost their houses. They understood how bad you can be if you lose your job. They swore they would never carry credit card debt again. We are now at $1.3 trillion in credit card debt, higher than the amount being carried at the peak before the last collapse.
That's not good news, is it?
But that's why I'm here to tell you.
So the average person is, the average cardholder, not the average person in debt, but the average cardholder is rolling over about $5,000 a month?
Closer to $6,000 a month.
Closer to $6,000
a month. That's carrying, those are balances being carried. I'm not talking about charged and paid off and getting miles or points or rewards. That's fine.
That's what's left over after
but
I pay my bill.
But that's what people are carrying, the average balance that people are carrying. And you know, we just finished having a discussion about, is the economy slowing? Does the market think it's slowing? Will the Fed say it's slowing? Is FedEx right? And now we have the highest consumer optimism really of any point, and retail sales are expected to reach records. And so in January, when those bills come.
Well, right. You've got a column up at terrysavage.com about these balanced transfer cards, which I'd never heard of before.
Because you never needed it before.
Well,
good for you. Actually, there are 40% of Americans have used a balance transfer card. Now, you cannot use a balance transfer card when your credit is totally ruined and you're way behind in your payments. But if you have on one or more cards a large balance and you're paying 22, 26, a lot of people are paying higher than that interest, there are balance transfer cards that will let you transfer your balance and give you a period, maybe 12 months, maybe 18 months, could be 2 years and some even longer, where you don't pay any interest on that balance. Now, you may be asking, why would banks do this? Because two things can happen. Either you pay it off and they realize they've got a good banking relationship. That was cheaper than a toaster, you know.
Right.
Or if you're in trouble at the end because you didn't pay it down, that interest rate's going to go up to 26, 28, 29%. But what it does is give you a breathing period in which you can pay down the balances,
so
you're not accumulating interest, which is the real killer.
So what percentage of people who get the balance transfer card actually use it for the right reason?
Yeah, that's the problem. Comparecards.com did this survey, and they say that plenty of 69% of consumers with household incomes of $100,000 or higher have used a balance transfer card at least once, and nearly half have done so multiple times. But the problem is that 41% one in four fail to pay off the balance. Sorry, no, I'm right. 41% don't pay off the balance in that amount of time. Now, balance transfer cards aren't this easy, simple thing, so I'm going to tell you what the column says, and then you can read it at terrysavage.com, or you can go to comparecards.com. Number one, you're looking for how long can I get this zero interest? That's 12 months, 18 months, 24 months. But beyond that, you want to find out what the fees are, because it could be 3% of your balance or more. Maybe there is no fee to switch it over. Exactly. Not all of them are zero interest. Some of them are low interest rates, but you're probably looking for a zero interest rate for at least 18 months with no fee, and you can find those, you can compare. And then you want to know what the interest rate's going to jump up to after the introductory period, and then is there a maximum transfer amount? And the other little catches are, what happens if you charge new things on this card? Because don't. It clicks all kinds of things into, you know, an interest rate on that. And from the minute you buy it, you're charged interest. So a balance transfer card can be a solution, but it's not a get-out-of-jail card for you. You've got to pay down your balance.
So read more at terrysavage.com or also comparecards.com.
Comparecards.com.
Nice to see you, Terry. We'll talk again soon.
Okay, next week.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. We'll talk cryptocurrency a little bit later in the program. How much do you know about it? Maybe more than me. It's one of those things, right? We all talk about it, but I'm not sure about our understanding. We'll be visited by an expert a little bit later on the Biz Lunch. Just speaking of experts, Frank Sennett is on the phone line right now from Crane Chicago Business. And, well, you named the topic, and Frank is an expert on it. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch, Frank.
Self-styled expert.
Self-styled. Self-styled is better than self-proclaimed, so you're doing okay. You know, you guys had a story up on your website, chicagobusiness.com, about the Census Bureau's American Community Survey. And what it did was it looked at the percentage of $200,000 home, what's the phrase, $200,000 households, and the increase since 2000, from 2000 to 2017, right? So how many more $200,000 households are there? And that was an awkward way to describe it, but I'm trying to get to the fact that number one and I think number seven were in the Chicago area, and number one was where Cabrini Green was, which I think is worth discussing. Yeah. Because, you know, we talk about the great development in Cabrini Green, and way back when in the 90s, people talked about, well, where will these people live who rely on that area? And now that went from zero, I think, $200,000 households to 39%. That's pretty amazing in 25 years.
Absolutely. I mean, the changes have been very stark there. You know, the high-rises are down. Some of the row houses are still up, but the high rises are long gone. A lot of the talk about mixed use development with you know, housing that was affordable as part of the mix that has come.
Uh-oh, Frank, did we lose you? We'll try to reach Frank again. I don't know if
hello.
Oh, there
hello?
You go. Yep. Did you go under a viaduct there, or what was going on?
You know, I was just sitting at my desk. So anyway, the fact is that they do have some affordable housing units as part of that mix, but it wasn't enough to obviously take in all of the folks from Cabrini Green. So they've been dispersed largely, and they're these really high dollar, some up to $2 million and above units. Housing units have gone in their place. And so you've seen this incredible rocket rise of wealthy households in that neighborhood that 20 years ago, we would look at each other and think, right, that's crazy to think that would happen.
That a block would be worth $200,000. But and then the other one, number seven, is at the Glen. And I guess that makes sense. They're similar stories in some ways, because the increase in $200,000 households at the Glen is because the Glen used to be the Glenview Naval Air Station, and so there probably were none there, or very few. And now with this, with the development there, that's increased greatly.
Right. So, I mean, I think that you're right in terms of this list. What it does show is not only neighborhoods that gentrify, but neighborhoods that really are transformed almost from scratch, right, which is, right, I think, you know, the case in both Cabrini Green, hugely remade. People displaced for the higher income folks, and then the Glen, yeah, just going from a naval air base to this really nice planned community.
Interesting to me too that the metropolitan area with the most increases in the top 10 was Washington D.C. So there's money influencing your government at its best. Okay, speaking of money and government and influence, there's a story up Claire Bushy wrote of Finkelsteel. And, you know, I drove by Finkelsteel. I used to drive under the arch all the time. I never really knew what they did, but they were involved in a military contract that they got last spring, I think, or early last summer, that they've now lost, and it's because of the Russian sanctions. Explain that to me.
Yeah, this is a fascinating story. So Finkelsteel had a $419 million weapons contract to help build a bunker-busting bomb, and the government has now upheld a decision to take that contract away because part of the ownership group of Finkelsteel is owned by a Swiss company, and that Swiss company has about 12% control by a Russian tycoon who is on a sanctions list. So through, you know, a couple of steps, they got directly to one of these guys on the Russian no-fly list. And that's why they've lost this contract.
Victor Vexelberg is the oligarch we're talking about here. And so a big loss for Finkelsteel. You know what I do when I'm really upset about a big loss, Frank?
What's that? Eat some cheese?
I bury my face in a burrata. Tell me about this store, the mozzarella store that's opening up on North Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, so that old Hershey store that was across from Water Tower Place is now a little bit more of an adult delectable offering of the mozzarella store. It's the creation of an Italian entrepreneur who is opening an organic cheese plant in Indiana between Indianapolis and Fort Wayne that will employ about 35 people. And he's going to open this mozzarella store to sell all this great cheese here in Chicago, and so, then he ultimately wants to open 20 to 30 of them around the country.
And the part of it is you would go there and you'd actually watch them make the cheese, right, or make a burrata or make a wedge of mozzarella. I don't know. But so what's interesting to me about that is because it sounds really silly, and you know, who's going to go to a specialty shop for cheese? But the banking here is that, you know, people don't just go to stores to buy stuff anymore. They need an experience, and maybe a mozzarella store can provide the sort of experience along Michigan Avenue that will bring people in.
That's right. And I will say this, though. If you see John Cleese behind the counter, you may not get what you want out of that cheese shop.
That would be bad news. All right, Frank Sennett, thanks for joining us today. Listen, have a great Christmas. We'll talk again soon, okay?
You too.
All right. Bye. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Have you been to a WeWork office before?
It's one of those co-working spaces all these kids are talking about these days.
Yep. And halfway through next year, there will be 9 locations for you to check out. The new location is arriving at 222 South Riverside, next to Union Station, taking the 15th and 16th floor of the building. This is what small businesses these days are using overwhelmingly, since you can use the space on an on-demand basis or schedule times that fit your company's workflow. This addition puts WeWork at over 500,000 square feet of space in Chicago, and that's nothing to gawk at, and neither is a lawsuit. Oh. GE is filing a lawsuit against Uptake as they claim the Chicago startup engaged in a, quote, ruthless scheme to poach their executives and trade secrets. Claims state that this, quote, scheme has been in the works for over a year and it's helped the company find its recent success. They're currently valued at over $2 billion. This could be quite the case. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, in the studio now, Brian Amoa is here. He's the principal at Chicago Crypto Capital. Brian, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
How are you doing, Steve?
Fine, thank you. I'll say on the air what I said off the air. You're going to have to talk slowly and use very small words for me, because I'm not sure that cryptocurrency is not above my head.
I'll try.
You're doing all right so far. So, all right, so I want to get into this, right? I'm going to come to you and I'm going to say, here's $10,000. I want you to buy Bitcoin. Smart move or bad move?
In my opinion, there's other opportunities in the space. Your $10,000 will probably work for you a little bit more.
All right.
What a lot of people don't realize is, or maybe they do, is Bitcoin is the first one, but it's been around for a long time. So that ship has sailed, in my opinion, but the technology just started. So some of these newer projects I would probably focus more on.
And so that's kind of the point of this whole thing, is that, you know, those of us who aren't professional investors or really up to speed on all of this, we hear about a headline product and we see this is probably something we should be paying attention to, but we don't necessarily have the expertise to do it, which can lead to some big mistakes.
And it's led to a lot of mistakes for a lot of people who were, you know, getting cryptocurrency tips from the shoeshine boy, you know,
right,
back in the day.
Actually, the one downstairs is pretty good. He's got some good ideas.
Yeah, he is. Open up in the shop right here, competing with us now.
So tell me in general about the cryptocurrency industry and then what sorts of opportunities might be there.
Well, the main, the area that we focus on and an area we find really exciting is with the private offerings and with these new launches of the new coins. Because that's where we're seeing a lot of the applications of this technology. It's where we're seeing a lot of the funding. It's replacing maybe some of these traditional type of funding, angel investing. Companies are finding cryptocurrencies a nice way that for investors, because it's transparent, it's cleaner, it's quicker. So a lot of these problems that, you know, maybe others had before are solved by
technology. But it is kind of hard to understand. I mean, I have a hard time understanding it. This cryptocurrency it will allow agencies to make transactions much more securely, much more quickly. But it's not like it's a technology like, you know, online data sharing or something. There are these individual coins. And so how do individual money makers sort of form into you know, one exchange, or how do we agree on which coin we're going to use in that?
So that's a great question. So if we take a look at a similar thing, a technological shift, the internet, the whole, and that's an extension of maybe the digital revolution. You could look at it and say, well, something's happened with these computers. Well, which program is it going to work? We know we're going to need accounting. And at the end right now, maybe you have a certain accounting company right now is the market share, and they're fighting with another accounting company. But that doesn't really have anything to do with maybe a video game company that uses the same technology. So if you understand that inevitably this technology is not going away, the choice isn't whether or not, you know, cryptocurrencies are going to be there. It's which one of these projects right now are going to be there.
This is mainstream. Will we end with one winner?
We will not. I don't see one coin to rule them all. That's just not the nature of cryptocurrency, is the decentralization. This idea that we're going to have one currency that we do for everything is almost the reasons cryptocurrency exists.
And so Chicago Crypto Capital, you guys identify... I mean, so the idea would be if I have money that I want to invest in cryptocurrency or the crypto industry, I would come to you. You would help me find places?
Yeah. I mean, as an individual, like anything else, it just gets to a point where you're overwhelmed. I mean, it's you versus the world.
Well, this one is, just as we're talking about, though, I mean, I think, you know, well, I asked you off the air, what level of sophistication do your clients have?
They individually are very sophisticated individuals, but in the sense that they know who to get to buy them stuff. So as far as cryptocurrencies, they know very little. I mean, we have one of our most infamous client, the probably one that gets mentioned the most, is the client that doesn't use email. We send him paper statements with his, you know, crypto holdings. And the reason we asked him, and we asked him afterwards, you know, why did you get into cryptocurrency? You don't even use email. And he said, you know what? Someone asked me to invest in the internet way back in the day, and I didn't do it because I didn't understand it. I'm not going to make that mistake again.
That's a great example. So that's kind of where we are, that this is, we know this is developing. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's like the cannabis industry in a way. Mm-hmm. We know, and that's easier for us to understand a joint than it is cryptocurrency.
Yeah, of course.
Right? So we know that something's happening there. Something's happening in cryptocurrency. We just need experts to steer us along.
So what our firm is doing is we're telling everyone to take a breath, because just because an industry is going to be profitable doesn't mean every single thing in the industry is going to be profitable. You had the pets.com and all the other famous failures of the .com because everyone knew the internet was going to be there. But that's not enough. When you're navigating a new field, you're going to have something that gives you an edge over everyone else. And ours is our research, our team.
Brian Amoah, the principal at Chicago Crypto Capital. How do people find out more from you?
They can visit our webpage at www.chicagocryptocapital.com. You can give us a call, 312-600-1842. One of our associates will take care of you.
Yeah, I think you did it. I think I understand. A little bit.
Well, a little bit will get you a long way in this industry.
It's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Steve.